From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. So as I'm watching this new show on Netflix, a song line came to mind for me. Keep your heart in your chest and your head in the stars. I think it's a line that applies to every episode of the Vince Staples show. Its creator and its star is sitting right across from me, Vince Staples. First of all, thank you so much for being here. But that line, because there's so much in that show about wanting more, but being stuck on Earth and just having to just sort of steady your gaze and steady yourself. Yeah. That's what the show is about for me.
For one, I appreciate the time, and thank you for speaking to me. Yeah, I think the show has a lot to do with perception, you know, blind optimism, you know, trauma, the things that we see and the things that we don't see. Just social norms, social anxiety, and just kind of how all those things are in the back burner of our human existence, whether we're cognizant of it or not. And, you know, most people coming from the background in which this show takes place are not cognizant of it. And I think that's what kind of builds some of the humor, because we're experiencing these things that we don't know that we're reacting to, but the world still forces us to react to them.
It's funny, because I think of your stuff and also, like, kind of that Odd Future connection. There's a kind of a almost like a magic realism that for me connects like to something back to like a Tribe Called Quest, which is having both the real world and a dream world in your head at the same time, and the dream world keeps getting pushed aside mm-hmm. by the real world. I want to say that the Vince in the show is kind of a dreamer, isn't he?
Yeah, I think what you're saying is, you know, very true. Those things are kind of constructs of capitalism. You know, society as a whole, you know, it doesn't necessarily work if we don't buy in. So those things kind of force you to buy in by the systems that we put socially, as far as government, religion, political affiliation, you know, capitalism. Again, it just kind of draws us to kind of fall into a box. We get to kind of pick the box a little bit, but we have to fall into one of those. And I think when you're creating music or anything creative, you kind of have to battle both of those things.
I love that the first episode is about jail, because you break open so many of the constructs about jail and a perception of jail. And we now live at the point where the police who arrest a hip hop artist will know his lyrics as compared to being afraid of him. And seeing Brian Greenberg from How to Make It in America now be a cop mm-hmm. and drop in Northside mm-hmm. to me made me laugh out loud. But the show, each episode is about perception and about knowing yourself. And I think so many of your songs, and they're about knowing yourself too. And did you want to bring that aesthetic to the show in a comedic way?
Like, even in the creation of the show, right, you'll be telling, you know, your collaborators, okay, this is what we're going to do, this is the idea. And they'll say, well, it's not like that. And then, like, say with the jail experience, and then my question will be like, well, have you been? And then everyone will say no, and it's like, you know, it's a waiting room. Like, it's pretty much just a waiting room. But having people kind of in that setting who are just, you know, human. Having people in the theme park who are just human. Now, there are two different sides of humanity. You have the friendly nature of humanity and kind of our need to kind of bond with one another in the jail with these people constantly trying to bond with Vince, whether it's the cops trying to bond with Vince, whether it's the first guy Robbie meets in the cell, or whether it's the older gentleman that he meets in the cell and Vince rejects it. And then you have the kind of more aggressive side of humanity with the theme park mascots, or the fear of the unknown is what that basically represents. And you have them kind
and
of...
And that manifests in every episode, that fear of the unknown, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. It relates to, you know, Vince not knowing who certain people are, who certain things are. And then Vince is constantly rejecting these things, but he's not able to because of what he symbolizes for the other people. It's kind of about the contrast that you feel when you're getting pulled in separate directions.
A comedy on the natures of black fame with my guest, the star and creator of the Vince Staples Show, Vince Staples. The show's on Netflix. We're on KCRW. You can get the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. So often I'm listening to your songs, I laugh out loud mm-hmm. just because it's about the absurdity of fame and about your being really kind of even keel about how absurd it is. And the show is that too, about how absurd fame is. I guess I want to ask you if you want to make a show about being seen for you as compared to for being seen as a celebrity, because there aren't many shows that we see certainly lots of white shows of this kind of thing, like Curb Your Enthusiasm or whatever. We don't get too many black takes on that. I wonder if that's something you thought you wanted to do with this because you do it in the music.
Well, yes. And, you know, when you're trying to create these things, people will say that there's no comparison, that there are no, this doesn't work or this doesn't make sense. The nonlinear storytelling doesn't necessarily make sense, but we have a woofer, we have a curd, we have a bass, because we have all these things that kind of will do it in a drier comedic standpoint. But you see, the main difference between that is kind of who's on the screen and who's creating it. So you'll have Noah's able to do white noise and kind of the dialogue just be super specific to him. But, you know, when we try to do it, it feels like it's just wrong. And I think it's important, at least to the companies, the corporations, so to say. But that's why it's up to us to kind of take these risks and try to create these things that have these singular identities, you know, whether it's hyper successful or not, because you can look at a David Lynch, you can look at a Wes Anderson and all of these people who are, you know, auteurs and who are brilliant and who the world loves, right? But they haven't necessarily reached the pinnacle of success. You know, combined, they're not half of a Spielberg. But I think that those lanes were carved out, I guess, just based on being content with the art and the creation of the art. And that's kind of where I sit with music and film.
It's funny because you're saying that. I think there's also a kind of a tradition of sort of black takes on surrealism. We go back to P-Funk. That was what you're talking about. George Clinton and his bands did that kind of stuff all the time with a sense of irony, but because it hasn't been done on the screen before. And again, I've seen this to you before we got started here. It seems like to me it's impossible to hear your music and not be able to extrapolate that you would do a show like this rather than just a two-dimensional sitcom about, you know, hip-hop archetypes.
Well, I think that a lot of the time the involvement in kind of correlates to people as the creation of. It's great to see The Wiz, but then you realize that was made by the dude who made, you know,
Serpico.
And then you go look at the last black man in San Francisco, and then you realize it's not a black man who made that movie. So from a corporate standpoint, it's kind of hard for them to understand those things, you know? And I feel like you, it's ridiculous when you really think about it, but like, these are why we deal with these things. And we deal in absolute sometimes. So we have to kind of get away from that and just be like, really step back and think how ridiculous a lot of these things are. That was a big part of the show. Like, the show is ridiculous on purpose, because it's literally ridiculous, and there's nothing wrong with pointing out the ridiculous nature of these things.
Because usually when we see violence, mm-hmm. especially in the black context, the like dramatic context, there's mm-hmm. tragedy.
Yeah.
It's, somebody's like wringing their hands and they're weeping, or it's made fun of. Mm-hmm. And again, each episode ends with something like that, but it doesn't change anything. And I know you're just talking in that sort of big abstract terms, but to just sort of treat this as like part of the everyday life, and mm-hmm. it's awful, but it doesn't change anything. And I want to talk to you about having that be such a big part of each episode, because there's an expectation about violence when it comes to like black drama or black comedy. And it feels to me what you're trying to do is what you do as a musical artist. You want people to ask questions about the cliches mm-hmm. and the everyday.
The violence is utilized as an anchor when things are going on that aren't understood, or that kind of can be looked at from a standpoint of Vince having a day that he can't necessarily process. I think the violence is the thing that anchors the day, because it's the thing that's familiar. And that's something that I derived from South Park. In the early seasons of South Park, they would be arguing.
Killed Kenny.
Yeah, and they would all not be friends, and then someone would kill Kenny. And when someone killed Kenny, then, you know, Stan and Cartman are friends again. And I think that was something that I kind of drew a lot from animation, just the way that...
Which other animation besides South Park?
Just a lot of early Warner Brothers stuff, just the constant chasing. I think Coyote and Roadrunner was kind of where I got the through line for episode. Basically, every episode is cut in half just based on what happened with it. These too many pages, too long, we can't produce
them. Oh, man.
So there's a lot. I think we did a decent job at connectivity, but there was a lot more context and Easter eggs and things like that throughout the episode. But obviously, when you're working, the cool things are the first things to go. So there were a lot of things like that within the show. But yeah, a lot of those Itchy and Scratchy, Tom and Jerry, like just the violence and kind of the adult, I guess, subject matter in a lot of those things was always interesting to me, because, you know, everything is done for a reason. Like, television is created for ads, not to entertain you. So when you think about the literal function of these things, music, all these other things, the radio, how do you kind of showcase what's going on? That's why I utilized the commercial for the last episode, because you were regurgitating the same
But it's also a payoff from the second episode, too.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's like when you think about the idea of what business is and what it takes to get a business understood by the people that pay for businesses, it's the messaging. What we say is marketability, things of that nature. So when you think about, we take our life experiences and what we learn from life, and then we use those to create, but we're just kind of regurgitating the human experience, right? So Vince takes, I guess, his desensitized viewpoint on violence. He takes that, puts it in a box of cereal. He lives with that same viewpoint. That viewpoint is now shared with the child. That child now shares the same viewpoint as Vince based on the day that he has. And then it's also regurgitated in an AdMet format, which he can understand, because now he is regurgitating that same thing with him watching the commercial, him eating the cereal, it's the hamster wheel, so to say.
In a couple of episodes, the first and last episode, somebody says, "It's a great day," which takes me back to Cube, mm-hmm. which is about, that whole song is about how absurd life is and mm-hmm. how violence comes out of nowhere, and you still have to keep going on. As you were talking about the cereal, which is, there actually are cereals that are explosive, you know, mm-hmm. Which also made me think of the whole cereal thing with Kaboom and Kill Bill, mm-hmm. but also this idea that he's creating this thing, that given that there's a lot of talk about food and the dangers of food in Black culture, mm-hmm. he's creating a sugary cereal mm-hmm. to sell to Black kids. Mm-hmm. You actually making fun of the hamster wheel
yeah.
that we can get caught on, aren't
and,
you?
And the funny thing is, he'll be like, zero sugar, zero preservatives, but you're replacing it with something that's just pretty much the same thing. Like, we were outside, I was talking to my manager, and he was like, the radio frequency sign that's in the parking garage. She was like, oh, that's interesting. And I was like, we have 50 frequencies pumping into our house every single day, from microwaves to Wi-Fi to wireless headphones, wireless chargers, phone chargers. There's so much stuff that kind of, we pick what we want to acknowledge is killing us, and then we kind of ignore the rest of the stuff. That's a big part of the show as well, and the things that are being paid attention to. Because it's like, you're at a theme park complaining about imminent danger. Is contradictory in and of itself.
I guess my guest wants us to hear the message from the end of school days. Wake up.
Exactly.
This show is the Vince Staples Show on Netflix. This is public radio. We don't sell anything here. It's the treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. I'm trying not to cough and laugh with my guest, Vince Staples, whose show, The Vince Staples Show, is on Netflix. This is The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. But you were talking about filmmakers, and clearly that last episode owes something to Raising Arizona as well,
yeah, for
which,
sure.
which is also kind of a live action take on a cartoon. And there's so much stuff in this, because you said cartoon, and you talked about the Warner Brothers, I'm thinking, you mean like the classical Looney Tunes
yes.
stuff. There's a lot of the show that feels like that. When the violence happens, like at the end of the family reunion episode, is an overly sentimental Gamble Huff production is playing mm-hmm. over that picnic and a fight breaks out. I don't think I know a Black person who hasn't been to that family mm-hmm. reunion, and where there's a fight over nothing. And there's so much in this show that's about pride.
Yes.
And how pride gets out of hand. And you do that a lot, too, in your music. I could probably name 10 songs of yours. You're like, the dangers of pride mm-hmm. are at issue. And I wonder where that comes from for you to go after that so often.
I've just always, I guess, been observant. And I think that's something I've always noticed ends poorly. I think about music in totality, right? Because it's easier to utilize something everyone understands. I can speak about my family situation, but let's speak about music. When you look at the greatest musicians of all time, any genre, you can go to Michael Jackson, you can go to Prince, you can go to a Elvis Presley, you can go to a Bob Dylan, you can go to a Whitney Houston. Most of the time when it ends, it just doesn't seem like it was, you know, a graceful walk off into the sunset. We still have enough pride to aspire to be these things, even though we kind of know it won't end well. But we want to be important. We want to be seen. We want to affect other people like these people affected us with how they were able to kind of pinpoint their traumas and try to make the best out of it and convey emotion, because you have to be an emotional person to kind of reach that level of success, because people have to feel you. And I think from that standpoint, even a familiar standpoint from the groundwork of family and friendship and art consumption, it's how we perceive things. You know, you go to a museum and you see, you know, Monet, like, or you see Rothko, or these people seemed miserable to me from an artistic standpoint. It's like I'm looking at the things that are being created from our creative people, and it's like it doesn't seem like they were having such a great time. But our pride as humans doesn't allow us to look into the details of Picasso and how that ended, which is, you know, not the best. And look at, you know, Van Gogh and, you know, all these people that we look up to. It's like we admire, they're the best, all we love. Basquiat, Andy Warhol, it's like that last week that he was still breathing was pretty rough. But our pride as human just blinds us from the inevitable. And when someone reminds you of the inevitable downfall of, I guess, just our existence, because life is not fair, and, you know, for any living thing, our only reaction is to fight back. So when, you know, Vince's mother brings this macaroni and cheese, something so just trivial, to the family reunion, you telling her that that doesn't matter, she's taking it as you're telling her that she doesn't matter. So her pride makes her fight to get to the bottom of something trivial. And then when you get to what you're looking for and there's still nothing there, you find something else.
You were talking about Warner Brothers cartoons, and I thought when you said that, I thought Vince is kind of like Bugs Bunny. At every point there's something that happens, he doesn't believe that the world can explode until it does explode. Mm-hmm. And in that particular episode, he really is like Bugs Bunny being chased by Elmer Fudd. He's running, and certainly he's concerned, but also he doesn't believe it. It's more what's going on than being afraid.
Yeah, and it's funny because a lot of the edit styles or just the shoot style I try to adopt, just the tone I try to adopt is strongly leaning on animation, strongly leaning on Roy Anderson, and just certain things that I feel like let things feel ridiculous or just comical in a sense, like trying to build out these larger set pieces and a lot of foreground, background action. I wasn't able to execute it the way I wanted to, but I feel like we have some really good moments of that in the bank, some really good moments of that in the pilot. Yeah, just really trying to find ways to let the environment kind of be in contrast to what Vince is feeling and having the background be in conflict with itself. Because then that gives you kind of three layers of, I guess, exploration for Vince, especially when you're dealing with limited shoot days and small, I guess, scope things. It's important to have things having conflict without it having to be in the dialogue.
My guest is Vince Staples. He's the star of the Vince Staples Show on Netflix. You can also see the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. But you said Roy Anderson, and there's a deadpan always in Roy Anderson stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, these unbelievable things are happening in long takes. The characters aren't reacting to it. Is that where you take your lead for playing Vince? Because he's really kind of not reacting to things in the way that we're expecting. And part of this, too, is I know you like the idea of thwarting expectation about what we expect from Black culture. But also, he's just kind of almost not reacting to anything. Again, that's why that line from Limos came to mm-hmm. mind for me. Mm-hmm. Because being caught between two places, you end up not reacting.
Yeah, I've definitely find a lot of a lot from the Roy Anderson stuff. I also think about what to react to, what brings someone to their wits end, picking your moments. You know, Marlon Brando did a great job at picking his moments. Paul Dano, someone recently, you know, I know there are younger people listening, someone that really picks their moments well. In the episode that is the bank, Vince feels relief and comfort in knowing the bank robbers, and that's a heightened moment.
That's like literal crime versus institutional crime. So you're pitting two things against each other.
Exactly.
He's being victimized, but when it's the kind of crime he understands mm-hmm. from people he knows, I mean, that to me is a fascinating episode playing with social constructs.
Mm-hmm. The tone of voice, the lack of, I guess, tense body language in the theme park episode. You know, he can handle the violence, he can handle all those other things, but he can't handle, you know, being taken advantage of financially. So when, you know, he's getting upcharged for the condiments after he gets the chicken and then he lets out a scream, the argument that he has with his girlfriend, like picking the moments to be heightened is something you see in a lot of Brando performances. some Clint Eastwood stuff.
Which brand of performances are you thinking about when you say that?
Of course, you can say some of the Godfather stuff, but I'm thinking Apocalypse Now. Not Apocalypse Now.
In the Jungle?
Yes, Apocalypse Now. Yeah. So when he shows fear is what I mean by the nuance in the performance, right? You pick your norm, and then you pick when to go against the norm. The whole performance, he's clearly bad crazy. But with the moments where he establishes that there is some fear, is the important break, because then that's what makes you human. You have the wall up, right?
Okay.
And then you have the people that are behind the wall. Now, sometimes when that wall drops, people might not know, but the character himself knows that the wall is being dropped.
Sure.
So how the character reacts to that, I think, is important. If you have a character that is telling everyone, I don't care, I'm not fearful, I'm not fearful, I'm not fearful, the moment that you show fear, you have that fear that's being shown, but you also have the fear of no longer having that guard up. And I think those subtle things are more important than, say, crying.
So often in the show, somebody showing fear, and we see Vince reacting to that fear because it takes him out of himself.
Mm-hmm.
It gives him something else to think about. As you're talking about bank, I was thinking about at the very end, mm-hmm. when he's walking with the bank manager, and I almost was screaming at the TV, don't go into your pocket. Mm-hmm. Because also there's so much going on in that, because that's also too about archetypes of behavior, and that a person of color, mm-hmm. in so many instances, knows what to do. I mean, as soon as he walks out and he doesn't put his hands up,
mm-hmm.
he's cast his fate to the wind.
Yeah, exactly.
And that to me is both a funny moment and a dramatic moment. And that happens a lot in the show. I mean, in that bank episode, all these social constructs you're talking about, the janitor, who we're not sure if he's a real person or an apparition,
mm-hmm.
and that happens a few times in the show, too, with your uncle in mm-hmm. the family reunion episode when he disappears. But he starts with Fargo, and then he goes to Barclay.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a history like banking being, one bank being taken over by another, mm-hmm. banks being, local banks being sort of absorbed into international banks, but also about how the stagecoaches mm-hmm. rob people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's so much going on in the show, but that's where we also get to see Vince's fear.
Yeah, exactly, because especially with, you know, trying to do the connection of banks to slavery or to just theft, historically. And it's funny because after the show came out, you know, there was that JP Morgan apology, I think, that they put out saying, hey guys, sorry for selling slaves, that was mean. Those kind of things are just so interesting. But
Wells Fargo on a regular basis having to apologize for something
without changing the logo, that's such an interesting thing, because once we hear that, we get uncomfortable. So seeing Vince's uncomfort is important to me. But I think in a streaming era and in a social media era as well with comedy, it's all like kind of slapstick and laugh out loud. And when I think about comedy, I think about, you know, Barton Fink. I think about just certain, a serious man, certain performances in certain Coen Brothers movies, which to me are hilarious. But they're funny because they're not, you know? And finding ways to kind of create a newer version of that in today's is a difficult feat. And I think that, you know, that's something that I'm up to try to make happen, because as much as I love, you know, a laugh out loud comedy. But the last one I remember seeing, even though it wasn't necessarily a comedy, was I think it was Matt Damon in Downsizing. He was so naive, and him remaining naive until the point it turned into innocence was, you know, a hilarious turn of events and just a funny social commentary. But it still had heart to it. It still had all those things. So I know it's possible to kind of create these things in this current landscape. It's just a matter of, you know, taking enough swings.
First of all, there's also deadpan in the Coens.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that sequence in Raising Arizona, he's running through all the supermarket just trying to steal and people shooting at him. He never shows fear. He's just mm-hmm. like, oh, what's mm-hmm. next? But also that section in the bank, I find myself thinking about the Hudsucker proxy. And there's an old black character who, to me, because the Coens don't use black characters very often, immediately, what's going on here? To remind us of slavery and ownership. But seeing that janitor sweeping up an empty hallway where he could have walked into the general manager's office himself.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly he has the keys, and I don't want to give the episode away,
mm-hmm.
to mm-hmm. being able to do things which he doesn't exercise. There is so much in that.
Mm-hmm. The fear of freedom.
That's something else that runs through the show,
mm-hmm.
the fear of freedom. That whole jail episode is about people who are much more comfortable being inside of an institution
mm-hmm.
than going outside.
I think it's important to showcase people that we're uncomfortable while we're comfortable. The biggest compliment I can get is like, you know, this is weird, or I don't understand, or I don't get it, or like, it's not funny. And that's just me being, I guess, a contrarian, as the internet likes to call me. But it's just, these questions are important to raise.
We just had this discussion, Kyle, with Paul Appel not too long ago. The idea that so much of comedy now is about things that you watch and you go, oh, that's funny.
Yeah.
Instead of laughing at them. There is stuff in it that makes you laugh out loud. Even though there's part of you, I think, that seems to distrust that, as a creator, as an audience, you still want that, don't you?
As a creator, I'll have things from my vantage point. I think, you know, it's hilarious. All the details, from just the wardrobing to just the blocking, there are so many things that I think are hilarious. I understand that it might not resonate for everyone. And I think it's very important to have things that are not for everyone, because that leaves room for discovery and that leaves room for interpretation. And if the thing that I think is laugh out loud has to be more of a show and not say thing, like we had a lot of script notes, and script notes would be like, I just don't know where the joke is. Like, I remember ending the bank episode, how it ended. Literally my favorite executive at Netflix, like, I don't know, guys, it's just not funny. And then my manager, he told Corey, he's like, dude, he's like, look, man, I'm with you a lot when it comes to kind of the stuff that Vince wants to do. He's like, but that is funny. And then he was like, I just don't know, man. He was like, I just don't know. He's like, well, if you're right, you're right. If I'm wrong, you're wrong. He's a really sweet guy. And then he said that he called him back. He's like, yeah, man, I still don't get it. But we played it for the company and everyone just started laughing. He was like, I still think it's kind of just wrong, but okay. And I like existing in that space to where you might not necessarily know.
When he goes into the bank manager's office and he's wearing, I mean, that jacket costs more than everything in the office, and he still won't give him the loan. That to me is just funny. I mean, because I know what he's wearing. So, mm-hmm. And so he finally gets credit from his boys, his friends who were robbing the bank, but also sort of playing heat for comedy.
Yeah. Just the disposition, the bank robber saying that he's not greedy, like understanding that function and kind of action don't necessarily go hand in hand all the time, and just kind of showing nuance. We had a note that was like, why is the bank robber saying that he wants a macchiato? It's like, you can't drink coffee and like rob a bank. These things don't, they should never clash to me. But I think it's important to show, you know, there is nuance in the environment and people and circumstances that no one takes out the time to understand.
Well, I can only say it's a very funny laugh out loud show. I'm sorry to say that to my guests. Vince Staples, the star and creator of the Vince Staples Show on Netflix. 5 episodes so far. I'm holding out hope for more. Please come back and do the show again.
Yes, sir.
From hip-hop star to Netflix star, rapper Vince Staples has moved to a more prominent position in front of the camera with his new streaming comedy series called The Vince Staples Show. From streamers to the stage to other screens, conversations on the whys and the wherefores at kcrw.com/thetreatment. The whys and other questions answered. It's The Treatment.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. You can also hear the show at kcrw.com/thetreatment. What do Robert Frank, Richard Avedon, and Mapplethorpe have in mind? In common, I mean to say. For me, what they have in common is the author, Philip Gefter, who's also brought his eye on the shift in pop culture phenomenology to a book on movies, marriage, and the making of Virginia Woolf. That's the subtitle. The book is called Cocktails with George and Martha. Its author, Philip Gefter, is here. Philip, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, hi. Thank you, Elvis. It's great to be talking about this book and that movie and that play.
So much when we hear about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, the debut of Mike Nichols as director, it's all filtered through Mike Nichols. His producer has almost always got short shrift, so much because I think the story is told by Nichols himself. But you give his producer, who was an accomplished screenwriter in his own right, a real chance to sort of offer his side of the story here.
That's true. It's as much Ernest Lehman's story as it is Mike Nichols' story. And just as Mike Nichols used to say about Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, it's as much Martha's story as it is George's story. So in writing the book, I was aware of those kind of parallel power struggles between Mike Nichols and Ernest Lehman as the producer and the director, and, you know, George and Martha as husband and wife, and also Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton playing, you know, both themselves and these characters as husband and wife. There's so many different power balances that went on. But Ernest Lehman, yes, I think he, you know, he kept a really kind of steady ship throughout the making of this movie and should be given more credit for his competence and his professionalism and all of that.
With the books you write, when they're all kind of set at a certain period and a shift in the firmament of the culture, but also about how these people who we think was the kind of legends didn't just do these things by themselves.
I mean, I was always interested in this movie from the time I first saw it when I was 15, which will date me because I saw it when the movie came out. But I mean, it was an amazing period in our culture. It was, you know, the 60s were, there was a generational shift, there was a cultural shift, it was a tumultuous decade. But each of the people involved, what interested me the most were four people, were Edward Albee, who wrote the play, Mike Nichols, who directed the film, and Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor, who were the most famous couple in the world. Well, how all of these, you know, these four people come together at a certain moment in time, and yes, I'll throw in Ernest Lehman because he was a more significant figure in the making of the movie than people understood.
And one of the things too that you do in the book, and it's weird because it is a pretty faithful adaptation of the play, Albee almost never gets mentioned. That must have fascinated you, because when people talk about the movie, they tend to talk about the movie as if it were this thing that never existed before.
Right. The way I came into deciding to write this book is as much about Albee as it was about the film. And I wanted to give Albee his due. And, you know, he was the visionary. You know, it's his observation of human nature that was so potent in terms of the play and why it became a phenomenon on Broadway before the movie was certainly ever even conceived and made. And so I wanted to give him his due, and I wanted to kind of underscore always that the movie was originally Albee's play. You know, Mike got to Hollywood to make this movie, and Ernest Lehman had written the screenplay, and he was both producer and screenwriter. And Mike, when he read the screenplay, he spent the next 2 months kind of both intentionally and surreptitiously peeling away Ernest Lehman's screenplay back to Albee's original script. Mike Nichols would tell reporters, "It's not my job to fix Albee. It's my job to reveal Albee." And so basically, you know, the movie is Albee's language and, you know, almost word for word throughout the entire movie.
It's also, in this way, incredibly theatrical. Lehman is terrified of being upstaged by Mike Nichols, who's terrified of being upstaged by the Burton-Taylor duo. And as soon as Nichols does something like have lunch with somebody incredible, then the next thing you know, Taylor Burton's are showing up with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
Oh, right. Exactly. Yes, exactly. I mean, that's a really, I love that anecdote, you know, where like they just started filming and there was one morning where, you know, Elizabeth can't quite reach Martha's voice. She has to lower her voice 2 octaves to play the woman who's 15 years older than she is. And she's having trouble and she's frustrated, and Mike is coaxing her and her husband is berating her, and she bursts into tears and storms off the set, and Richard Burton follows her. And this is about 10:30 in the morning, and everyone's waiting and waiting and waiting for the Burtons to come back so they can continue shooting. And then it's lunchtime. And after lunch, the Burtons haven't come back, and it's 3 o'clock and now it's 4 o'clock. And of course, this is time is money, you know, in the shooting of a movie. The Burtons saunter back at 4:30 laughing, jovial, with another couple in tow. And they introduced Mike to the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, with whom they had just had lunch. And of course, it puts everything in perspective for Mike and Ernie, too. It's sort of, they understood where the power really was, you know, in terms of who was truly in charge. And it was always the Burtons, because they were the most famous couple in the world.
No, and as you mentioned in the book, the shooting day started at 10 a.m. and ended at 6, which meant at 5 o'clock, somebody was showing up with a picture of Bloody Marys, and in fact, the shooting day was over.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the pictures of Bloody Marys would start at noon, even just before lunch. And then, you know, the amount of drinking, the alcohol consumption behind the scenes eclipsed what was actually in the film. I mean, so if we, you know, watching the movie, you see George and Martha just like, I don't know how many drinks they have over the course of this late night nightcap, you know, 25 drinks or something. But what was happening on the set, like they were drinking just as much. What the Burtons brought to their roles, you know, they had a real life marriage that was just as mercurial as George and Martha's marriage on screen. And so I talk about it in terms of a kind of prismatic verisimilitude that they bring to their roles. And that's what makes the movie that much better. George and Martha are played by Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, who were George and Martha. And and you see that balance. I see it because I see the movie now, like, I don't know, 70 times. But I can actually see when Richard Burton is talking to Elizabeth Taylor as George is talking to Martha, and you can actually see the actors talking to each other as opposed to their characters talking to each other. And it's kind of stunning.
We're talking about an important film in the history of film and an important book about the making of an important film. The book is Cocktails with George and Martha, Movies, Marriage, and the Making of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf by my guest, Philip Gefter. It's The Treatment, which you can also hear at kcrw.com/The Treatment. As you were talking about Albee's impact, I was reminded of you ending the book with the litany of plays and movies that absorbed that marriage as a battleground context.
I think the movie is about a marriage, but it's also about marriage. And I mean, for me, early on, I realized that this movie is, I felt, the definitive movie about marriage, against which all other movies about marriage are measured, as far as I'm concerned. And so I take that, you know, idea in the book. I use my last chapter to kind of write about a genre of films about marriage that doesn't exist and I think should exist. And so, you know, I talk about 18 or 19 films throughout the history of cinema that address marriage and how the way film addressed marriage changed after Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. Before Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf in the mid-60s, you know, movies would reveal married couples as the main characters, but there was always another plot through which their marriage would, you know, be observed. After Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, marriage became the central, the subject of any number of films, and more directly, and I think more psychologically. And so it was significant. I mean, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was significant in changing that in cinema to begin with.
You mentioned seeing it as a teenager. What do you recall about the impact it had on you? Just because I just grew up reading about it, because that happened sort of before my time, but about the fact that it sort of, in effect, more, I think more so than Bonnie and Clyde, really set into motion what became the ratings board and did away with so many things that, because there had to be, for you, and I'm wondering if you were aware of this, a before and after with that movie, because you were kind of old enough to recognize how the firmament changed under your feet.
The movie had radical effect both on film and on in the culture itself. Another thing Mike Nichols did is he refused to get rid of a lot of the kind of incendiary language. And at the time, you know, to curse, like to see curse words on the big screen was unheard of. And that's, there was a production code and a censorship board. And Jack Warner was living in fear that the movie would not be accepted. because of the language. And Mike Nichols was intent on keeping the language. But 2 years after that, the production code was disbanded altogether. So this movie brought about the change and a new rating system for what could be seen on the big screen. That was huge at the time. So when I saw it, I was 15, and the name alone got my attention, and I asked my parents if I could see this movie, and they said, well, they didn't object to my seeing it, but they said, you won't understand it. And I saw it, and they were right. I didn't really understand it, but I recognized something really true in it, and I actually recognized my parents in it, as well as the parents of friends of mine. You know, it's not that my parents behaved as badly as George and Martha at all, but I understood there was something true about it. Like, it was the first time I'd ever seen that in film, whatever that was, and I couldn't really identify it at the age of 15, but I knew it was true and real, and it was about marriage, and I, you know, that was larger than my ability to understand at the time, but it stuck with me. It's always been one of my favorite movies for that reason. And as I saw it over the years, several times, it started to make more and more sense to me.
I wanted to ask you that because I feel like there is a lot of you in this book, and and the ways that the other books that I've read of yours don't feel quite as personal. I feel like you're commenting on something that you were like in a phenomenon you were watching kind of at ground zero, and you were aware of how the world was changing. And I really feel that in the writing here in the way that I hadn't before.
I felt the movie very personally. I mean, I've always had a kind of psychological take on things. And marriage has always been, I've always been interested in it. I've always, when I was that age, you know, in writing my introduction, I realized that marriage, I felt like marriage when I was growing up was an institution as large as government or religion. And, you know, I've revised my view of that over the years. Although I do think marriage is, I do think it's absolutely, you know, it is one of the pillars of all societies, for better or worse. And, you know, I've been observing my own marriage and the marriage of friends of mine and, you know, marriage and literature and all of that. And so it's always been something that has interested me because I think it's marriage manifests, you know, you can see like human nature being manifest all the time. And this Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is such an amazing metaphor for me, like for all of us to kind of observe human nature in action. So yeah, it's my story. It's everyone's story, I think.
I think there's something that you respond to here as well, which is the daring of Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton to do something like this, because they certainly didn't have to. They could write their own ticket. They could do whatever they wanted to. And to throw themselves into this thing that scared both of them on a fundamental level as actors was really, I can't think of a modern day equivalent of somebody doing something like that, that was this much of a test, doing something that hath this life of its own in the culture that was revered and feared in the way that that play was. And for them to do this. And as much as we can make fun of Jack Warner that he bought this, you know, a few years after they did My Fair Lady, says a lot about what that studio was too, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah. No, it's really, it was very courageous of them. It was very courageous of Jack Warner. I think people really took a huge leap in faith and, you know, they really did bring courage to the project because it was, it punctured so many hypocrisies, that movie. And it also, you know, here's Elizabeth Taylor, the most beautiful woman in the world, and Richard Burton, you know, they were the most famous couple in the world. They were at the top of their careers. And, you know, Elizabeth Taylor did not have to make this movie, and it was a huge stretch for her, and it was a stretch for Burton as well. She was 32. She was playing Martha, who was, you know, a 48-year-old, you know, menopausal woman who was coming apart at the seams, 20 pounds overweight. You know, she had to really stretch her abilities, Elizabeth Taylor, to play this role. And she rose to the occasion. I mean, it wasn't easy, and you can read about it in my book, you know, the tantrums she would throw. And there was one moment when the first time she had to be made up as Martha, just so they could see what she would look like, she threw a tantrum, and at one point she said, I don't see why Martha can't be 33 years old. Why does she have to be 48? And unfortunately, they didn't indulge her on that one. But it was really funny, you know, like when I was reading about this in Ernest Lehman's production journal, how hard it was for her. You know, she had to lower her voice 2 octaves throughout the entire making of the film. And Richard Burton as well, you know, he was a force of nature and on the screen, and they didn't want to cast him because he was too powerful for his role as George, who was had become a kind of milquetoast, you know, broken man. So it was really hard, you know, for both of them to do this. And they were taking a huge leap, you know, of faith. She was making $1 million a film. Now, that doesn't seem like much in today's, you know, economy, but that was the equivalent of, I don't know, $10 or $15 million at that time per film. And that was huge then. That was more than anybody was ever making. And this was a huge risk, because if the film had bombed, it could have destroyed her career.
The book is Cocktails with George and Martha, Movies, Marriage, and the Making of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. My guest is Philip Gefter. And Philip, I can't thank you enough for doing this. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.
They published your diary, and that's how I got to know you. The key to the room of your own and a mind with
fire. Writer Philip Gefter's new book is Cocktails with George and Martha, Movies, Marriages, and the Making of Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's The Treatment.
When the voice at the other end comes like a long lost friend, so I know I'm all right. Life will come, life will go. Still, I feel it's all right. Cause I just got a letter to my soul. Has its place. Ooh. The hatches were battened, the thunder clouds rolled, and the critics stormed. The Babel surrounded the white flag of your youth.
It's The Treat. I'm Elvis Mitchell. Writer-director Lulu Wong's newest project is the adaptation of Expats for Amazon Home Video, a drama about feeling adrift. For The Treat, her thoughts on being much more connected to the earth.
I'm Lulu Wong, and this is The Treat. I've been reading a lot about permaculture. I think because I've been gardening, and it was something that I discovered during the pandemic. I just, you know, had time like so many of us did. And so I started growing things. And now I've grown a lot of food in my garden, vegetables, tomatoes, fruit trees. It makes me think about my grandmother in China. When I was very, very young, before we left for the States, she lived in a house where she had a garden. And later in life, that was turned into like a shopping mall or something. And so she lost that house. But it's one of my most cherished memories is pulling carrots out of the garden. And so whenever I'm in the garden, I feel connected to her. But what I love about reading about permaculture is understanding that everything is connected, and that when you put a seed in the ground, you know, that simple act that things will grow, and that everything affects each other. When you have your hands in the soil, in the earth, you feel like a human being, really. And it feels like, okay, no matter which soil I'm on, I can still grow many of the same things. It does make me feel rooted, you know, for lack of a better word, to literally see things take root in my own house. I never thought I would have my mind blown buying cherry tomatoes, but a tomato that you grow in your garden does not taste like any tomato that you get at grocery stores, just because of, you know, the transport, and they often pick them before they're ripe. And in your garden, you eat them right off the vine, the way they smell. Like, I think just that, like, that was just incredible to me, how something so simple that I'd known my whole life, like a tomato, could be seen in a completely different light. And so it made me think a lot about storytelling and perspective, and how, you know, stories that we live our lives by, that we believe in for so long, and then you see it from a different perspective, and it can completely shift your reality.
The Treat, from writer-director Lulu Wong, Her Garden. Documentary director Brooklyn Sudano on her garden and other previous treats, not so earthy, at kcrw.com/thetreat. From inspirations that are literal to psychic stimulations that draw on areas more figurative, from figures in the arts and other endeavors, that is The Treat. And this is The Treatment, produced and edited by Rebecca Mooney and mixed by Katie Gilchrist. And we've had help from Laura Kondarajan, Phil Richards, and Sumar Galees. Plenty to be literal about here. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.